you can host the best backyard barbecue. When you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
Welcome back to Kotaku Split Screen, the only podcast that hasn't yet been monetized into a series of loot boxes. It's June 27th, 2019, and we tried and failed to do a speed run of this episode, although we do still discuss some cool runs from Summer Games Done Quick. I'm finally playing Outer Wilds, and Jason beat it, so he has some helpful tips for me. We talk about Metroidvanias, and then we get to the news, which runs the gamut from the unnecessary controversy of Tifa's boobs to the rise of auto chess and working conditions at Treyarch. We close it out with off-topic talk about Evangelion and so much more. Let's get to it! Welcome back to another episode of Kotaku Split Screen. I am Maddie Myers, and I'm joined, as always, by my co-host Kirk Hamilton. Hi, Kirk.
Hello, Maddie. It's so nice to see you.
It's nice to see you, too. And it's also nice to have my other co-host, Jason Schreier. What's up, Jason?
Hello, 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 hello. We've got to go fast, because I've been watching Summer Games Done Quick all week, and I'm just feeling really speedy.
Mm-hmm. It's going to be a speed run episode.
I feel like we can do better than last week's like 3.5 hour episode. I think we can probably go a little faster this week.
Yeah, yeah. Let's speed run this one. Let's try to glitch our way out of the borders of this episode of Kotaku Split Screen. Mm. Yeah, I mean, have you guys been watching, by the way, Summer Games Done Quick? Always one of my favorite things every single year.
I haven't been. I'd like to check out some of the runs later today, but I just haven't had the time to check them out. I know you've seen some of them, though, Jason.
Yeah, there have been some good ones. There was a really fun one where they beat Super Mario Brothers 2 in like 25 minutes. And that sort of thing always blows my mind, because I remember playing Super Mario Brothers 2 as a kid on my NES and like never being able to get past the first world. So they would take me hours of struggling to just like get into the second world. So to watch someone just like blaze through it is always a little mind-blowing. And I just this morning, I was watching someone play this game called Booger Man. Have you guys heard of this game, Booger Man?
No.
Okay. I have not.
So it was designed, I'm not really sure where it came from. It was an Interplay game. And it was kind of like made as a gross out game, I guess, for kids. And so you play as this superhero in a cape named Booger Man. And his special attacks are like farts and like picking his nose and like spitting and stuff.
Sure.
And it's set in a world where you like travel by flushing yourself down toilets and like you fight like zit monsters and other like gross out humor creatures. And I remember playing it as a kid and loving it when I was like 8 years old or 9 years old. And so it was amusing to watch it get speed run as weird and gross as it actually is.
Nice.
Yeah. And probably weird to remember that game existed. I mean, I've never heard of it.
Extremely weird that game. You have to look up footage. The thing I was noticing as I was playing this morning or watching this morning is that the animations are actually really good. It's got all these incredible like 2D animations of him farting. So if you ever wanted to see like really well handcrafted booger animations, this is
that's
your
game. Funny. I feel like there are so many games like that from, you know, from that era that I've completely forgot about. That if I then heard about it, I'd be like, holy shit, I remember that game. And it's also funny to think about. Like, I wonder what the person who did those animations does now, because, you know, a lot of times it's like, oh, yeah, the guy who made this or the lady who worked on that was actually responsible for the thing in this ridiculous game that no one even talks about anymore.
Yeah, the other really, really good throwback, not from GDQ, but just like a game that I was thinking about recently, is there's a game called MC Kids. And it came out in 1992 for the regular Nintendo, and it was a game about McDonald's. It was like a giant licensed product for McDonald's. Okay. So it was an advertisement.
Was it starring those kids that appeared
in all of those ads. Yeah, yep. I remember that collection of diverse kids.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah, funny. Who I guess were called MC kids.
Yeah, they're the MC kids. One of them is white and one of them is black, and you played as them.
One of them
and you
is in
around.
A wheelchair, et cetera, et cetera.
Oh, no, no, no. So this is only
two. Oh, it's not all
two,
of them.
Because it's only two players. It's okay, Mick sure. and Mac. And so you go around and you like meet, you hang out with the Hamburglar and like Ronald McDonald.
You hang out with him. You don't have to like foil his exploits or
yeah,
whatever.
Yeah, no, you have to chase after him because he stole a bag or something. And you have to go around and collect these, like, instead of collecting coins, because it's basically a Mario knockoff, but instead of collecting coins, you collect M's, like gold M's from McDonald's. And it's just designed to make you to make you hungry for McDonald's.
I feel like the modern version of that would let me hang out with the Hamburglar. Like now I want to play the game where you actually hang out with the Hamburglar.
Or you play as him, like a
dating
Wario
sim?
Situation.
Yeah, where you're, right, where you're the Hamburglar. I guess that's kind of Persona 5. You're basically the Hamburglar in Persona 5, right?
Yeah.
Kind of
yeah,
what that game steal, is about.
Except instead of stealing burgers, you're stealing people's hearts.
Right, right. Same difference.
That's what the Hamburglar does now, right? Didn't they have a reboot where he's like cool now?
It's, probably. That
they're
right.
poised for the dating sim meets Persona-esque RPG centering
if they,
McDonald's.
If they were to do that game, it would be like the Hamburglar finds himself in a 2019 world where everyone's eating Impossible and Beyond burgers, and he's like, what the fuck? And he has to go and like rescue the real burgers, save the meat.
He's a man out of time, that Hamburglar.
Let's talk about some other video games. The video games we're actually playing instead of throwback McDonald's games. Let me start because mine is really easy. I have only been playing Outer Wilds, which we went into in depth last week. I finished the game. It is, I think, safe to say, one of the best games that I've ever played. Certainly one of the best. Certainly my favorite of the year. Certainly one of my favorite of the decade. It's unlike anything I played before. I wrote an article telling people that, and we've talked about it extensively. Kirk, thank you for the recommendation. I think for those of you who have not heard us talking about it before, this is just a space exploration game that is unlike anything you've played because your currency and your collectible and your tool for the game is information. It's also very easy to spoil, so don't read anything about it. But yeah, really good. Everyone should go play it, which leads to Maddie because you are also playing Outer Wilds. You
just started,
right? Because Kirk and I wouldn't stop raving about it.
Yeah, and you know, I'm a good friend. I like to play things that people tell me to play.
Yeah.
I'm glad you guys told me how good it's going to get because I feel like my initial experience with it has been a lot of getting lost, and I don't know that I would go back and keep trying to play it if I didn't know that there was some more good stuff coming. But so at the very beginning of the game, I'm sure people know this, but to review, the beginning of the game, it's not in the time loop. You can walk around this alien village as long as you want before you leave on your journey, and you can talk to people. That part of the game is fairly straightforward. You sort of understand how to do things. You get to practice repairing a satellite, but it's not really a satellite. All that stuff I totally understood. I was on board. I like the alien characters so far, and I don't know I'm ever going to see them again because I just abandoned them all on that planet. But I liked the world. I liked all the setup. But then I left. I went into space, landed on a planet, immediately died. let me think. There were a few planets that I landed on and died in a comical way in a row. So
that's part of the appeal.
Is it? Well, no, I know. But at first, there were definitely some moments when I was like, is this appealing? Am I having fun currently?
I would say that it's part of the experience, if not part of the appeal.
I've played games like this. The first one, I think, I ended up on a planet. I don't remember the names of the planets, so you'll just have to forgive me. I should have been taking notes for this show.
Well, we'll tell you if you just describe it a little
bit. You probably will. So I landed on a planet that I guess had some sort of, like, either quantum or black hole type of a dealie, which I know is a thing in this game.
Brittle hollow.
And it, whatever it was, propelled me way out into space, like super, super far. And then I was like, I don't know how to get back, so I guess I'm just going to die in space. So I died in space. And
nice.
Then got back in my ship, and I was like, cool, I feel like I did something wrong, but maybe I didn't. And then I went to a different planet and died in a different way. I think just getting lost, and I don't fully remember that death. That was less of a concrete death. Mm-hmm. And then I went to a different planet, and it's the planet, the quantum planet, where you like are looking at gateways and stuff like that, and you're sort of solving puzzles. It reminded me a lot of Myst, actually. And that was around when I was like, okay, like this is more of a video game. Like, cool, I understand what I'm supposed to be doing. I'm reading tablets. I'm walking around solving a puzzle. But it was definitely like, the game doesn't hold your hand at all. I mean, I guess this is a mild spoiler for this puzzle, so people can skip it if they want. I'll be super vague.
Or but maybe it'll be helpful. Like maybe it'll help people who are stuck on it.
Because it took me a while to figure it out. I eventually figured out that you can take pictures with this tool that you have. It's like a little additional probe that you can fire in a direction.
You didn't play through the tutorial?
I guess not. I don't know. I knew I could do that, but I didn't like connect it as something that I had to do in this particular moment. But you read a clue that's like a quantum object. Seeing a quantum object is the same as observing it or whatever that means. And I was like, okay, cool. So maybe if I can take a picture of an object, that means something. But it took me a really long time to figure out that I needed to like take a picture of a gateway in order to get it to stay in one place, but also like keep the picture open. Like I couldn't just take the picture and then...
Right, because you need to be
away.
Observing it. It has to be, you have to be looking at it in order to stick it in time.
Obvious. Okay. I get it mechanically.
No, totally.
But it's like a gamey solution to a problem that my brain had solved. Do you know what I mean? It's fine. I think I'm like going to get the hang of this game, but there were definitely some moments last night when I was like, this reminds me of being a child playing Myst and just like walking around the cavernous areas of Myst for an extremely long time and being like, I know there's something I'm supposed to do here, but I don't know what it is. And sometimes that was a good feeling, but sometimes it's like, God, this is a lot of walking around.
let me give you a couple of tips because it sounds like you need some. First of all, make sure that in the opening planet you're like do all the little tutorial things because they'll give you some guidance on like taking pictures and seeing ghost matter and knowing what that is. And
sure,
like
I did the hide and seek one, and I did the satellite repair one.
Okay, yeah, you need to go do the ghost matter one because that's important.
Okay,
and also talk to everyone on the home planet and just like pay a little attention to everything. Second tip is now that you know the hide and seek, so you know how the signal scope works. That's
your radar
that lets you find people's signals. Use that to find some of the other Outer Wilds travelers, because once you find them, that'll help you steer you in a direction. Because part of the experience is like wandering in space and figuring out what you have to do and then making a checklist in your brain of like, okay, these are the things that I want to go and do and explore and be curious about. And that I think will help you add some structure to this and slowly start to figure out what's going
on. I mean, I don't dislike it, and I think it's just a matter of getting the hang of it after a while too, because there's a lot of the game has a particular look as well. Like there's platforming aspects that can be kind of frustrating, which you mentioned, Jason, and there were definitely moments when I was like, I am stuck in a place that I don't want to be stuck in, like a weird area of a planet that, like at one point I landed on a planet and I was just like in the water for a while and I could see a place I could get to if I could only get out of the water. But I was like, well, I can't. So I guess I'm just stuck here and I need to just reset this save and like land on the planet in a more opportune angle so that I can like actually land on it. Do you know what I mean? Like, did any of this stuff happen to you guys?
I mean, you can always fly the ship out of the water.
Yeah, but you have to be able to get back in it. Like, there were moments when I would get a little like literally stuck in the game on something. I don't know.
Oh, you mean like you'd be outside of the ship and then you wouldn't be able to get back to the ship?
Oh, yeah. Clipping on a texture of some kind. Like, the game, and sometimes that happens and you're like on a weird experimental looking planet and nothing looks like anything. So I'm like, I don't even know what direction to go. But, you know, I get it. I get that it's going to be really cool. I'm going to keep trying.
Yeah, you know, so I've heard from a lot of people who have been like, oh yeah, I couldn't really get into this, and then who have basically been like,
I think this is why. I'm going to keep trying it because I've heard so many good things, but I understand also why someone would play it for a couple hours and be like, I don't get this, you know?
Completely. And I've heard from people who say that, and it's that funny feeling when you've played a thing that you think is sensational, that did take some sticking with for you to get into it. And then hearing other people basically saying, and it's I would totally not begrudge someone for playing this if they hadn't heard somebody telling them this is an amazing experience that's worth completing. You know, like I could totally see somebody thinking, oh, well, okay, like I don't know, this seems fine, but whatever, I'm not going to keep playing. I do that all the time with games. I even do that with games that people tell me are good. So so I'm not surprised to hear that.
I had no idea, Kirk.
Yeah, believe it or not. But
no, Kirk's beaten every game he's ever tried. We all know
true.
That.
It's true. But yeah, so that is sort of is understandable. And I think it's weird because it puts you, when having finished the game, it puts you in the kind of uncomfortable position of really wanting to not come on so strong and be like, oh, like it's so good, play it, because whatever, like people can do whatever they want. And I know that even the feeling of resentment that can build when people keep telling you something is good.
I don't feel that way about it. It's different because I've played games like this, and so I know how rewarding they can be, and I kind of want to be able to get ahead to the rewarding part, but I also know that part of getting to it is dealing with the part where I don't fully get it yet.
There's a groove you'll get into after a few hours. It's and really I'm talking about other people that I've talked to as well. It sounds like you're, you know, sticking with it, and I'm just, you know, you're just explaining your experience with it, but I've heard from people who have sort of been like, yeah, I played some and couldn't get into it. I don't know. Maybe I'll go back to it. And I always am like biting my tongue. I'm like, you know what? I'm not going to do the thing where I keep telling you how good it is. This is my said my piece. You know, I think it's good. Play it if you have time, and don't if you don't, and it's fine. But I am glad you're playing it because it's pretty great. And the ending is good. I think that's something that will be heartening for some people to hear, is it ends super strong. And I'll say no more about it than that, but the ending is amazing. So yeah.
Yeah. Follow my tips and I think you'll have a better time. What else are you playing, Manny?
Oh, I'm also playing the Pokemon Go rival Harry Potter Wizards Unite, which is a better game, frankly, but it's also much more of a single player game than Pokemon Go is. There's no team-based system. Like my girlfriend's also a Harry Potter nerd, so since we've been playing so much Pokemon Go together, I was like, this is great. We'll both get the Harry Potter game. We'll be able to play together, and we're both going to be Team Slytherin, so we'll be on the same team.
Oh, wow. Team Slytherin.
But, well, just what like, reporter we're gonna... isn't a Slytherin? Come on, Jason.
Just embracing the evil.
Yeah, it's fine. So we're both Slytherins, but it doesn't matter. There's no team bonuses in this game. There's no, like in Pokemon Go, it being on the team super matters. You claim gyms in the name of your team and you fight against the other teams. And like all over the world, teams are vying for dominance and there's only three teams, et cetera, et cetera. So I was like, okay, cool. Harry Potter will probably do that too. But it's really not like that at all. There's a narrative in the game for one thing, which is interesting. Like there's story and there's like a common enemy that you're all fighting. It's not Voldemort. It's just some other dark wizard guy that they invented for this. As far as I know, I haven't read like every encyclopedic Harry Potter
thing. It's their version of Grindelwald. Isn't Grindelwald the guy from the new movies?
It's some other guy. Yeah. And then there's other new characters, but also like older Harry and older Hermione are there as well. So there's some familiar stuff. But mostly it's like every person playing the game all over the world is working together to fight against this dark wizard and his shenanigans. And being on the same teams doesn't really matter because there's not really a PvP aspect, at least that I know of, that could emerge later in Pokemon Go.
But if you're Slytherin, shouldn't you be siding with the dark wizard?
That's not true.
Yeah, like, that is some slander of Slytherin, Jason. That's not Slytherin isn't just dark and evil.
A lot of Slytherin sided with Voldemort.
A lot, but not all. Let's not generalize.
That's propaganda.
That's just not helpful.
Yeah, let's not generalize against the racist, like, evil literally designed to be evil.
You know Gita's a Slytherin too, right, Jason? You're gonna start creating a rift at work over this fight.
Yeah, this is gonna become a problem.
Yeah, I mean, maybe you guys should go, like, hang out with the Dark Lord.
Slytherins are loyal. Slytherins are career-oriented. We're not all racist and we're not all evil. It has to do with personalities and not just political allegiances. Mm-hmm. Anyway,
I think I just heard you slip a Mudblood in there, so don't be dropping those.
You're right. You know what? I'm not racist, but I do hate Muggles. Anyway, yeah. So it's a cool game. I'm just a little sad that there aren't some other aspects to it that rely on playing with other people, but also that might be for the best because it seems like this game just isn't as popular as Pokemon Go was. I wrote a post pretty early on after it came out about how I haven't run into anybody else in the street who's playing it, and that is still the case. Like, I've been playing it since it came out and I have yet to run into anyone else in the wild who seems to be playing it. So I don't know. It's a pretty fun game.
Yeah, I mean, it makes sense, right? Because you think that Harry Potter is like universally appealing. It would work for something like this. But I don't know. Pokemon Go was A, kind of like a flash in the pan, mm-hmm. and B, like lightning in a bottle, and B, it was like built for a game like this as opposed to Harry Potter, which is a lot more, it sounds like the game from what I read of what you wrote about it and what you're describing now. It sounds like it's a lot more complicated and less like you can go catch them all. The other thing I kept thinking is that, like, even though this doesn't seem to have caught fire, I think Minecraft Earth could be a lot more appealing because that seems a lot more built for like an AR type of game.
Well, and bear in mind that also this is also true of Minecraft, but Pokemon was a video game, and the people who play Pokemon are gamers, where Harry Potter is not a video game first and foremost, mm-hmm. so you don't have the built-in audience.
Although I'm super excited for that rumored leaked Harry Potter game whenever that thing actually comes out, because it looked really cool.
Oh, that like total other game that doesn't have anything to do with this?
Yeah, the Avalanche game.
We're just talking about Harry Potter now.
Oh, yeah. Way more excited for that than like another AR thing on phones. So would you recommend people actually play that, Maddie? Is it worth downloading?
Yeah, I mean, especially if you like Pokemon Go, I think it's definitely fun. I think there's more to it. And also, if you're a person who didn't like Pokemon Go because you felt like it didn't have enough game in it, this could be the solution to that, because there's a lot more game in it. You can make potions, which I find really fun. You can collect ingredients. There are greenhouses where you can grow ingredients, and walking around the world and collecting potion ingredients and making potions that then help you in battles is just like an inherently fun game mechanic.
Nice.
And I enjoy doing that.
Cool.
So, yeah.
Kirk, what about you? What are you playing?
I've just played a little bit of a lot of things.
Shocker. Kirk Hamilton has played
I didn't know what to play. After Outer Wilds, I'm feeling kind of, you know, yep, I don't know. I'm having a hard time getting into anything
else. I feel like we got to get you like some kind of life coach for your gaming habits. You keep being like, I don't know what to play. I can't figure out what to play.
You know, I don't know. This time of year, I guess, or this where I'm at in my life, something. I don't know. But I played a little bit of some things. First of all, just a quick story. This is sort of funny. I have been an advocate of the Xbox Pro controller, which is the outlandishly expensive but very nice controller.
Elite controller.
The Elite, maybe that's it. Yeah, not Pro controller. Right, that's the Switch.
Yeah, Nintendo has the Pro controller.
Right, it's not for pros.
Those are great and also similarly stupidly expensive, but yeah, anyway.
This is minor league, but it is elite. It's for elite members of the non-pro community. So it's good. I like it. I like all these kinds of cool controllers with buttons on the bottom, but you saw that Microsoft announced a new one of these at E3, mm-hmm. and then literally less than a week after that, the rubber started coming off of the handle on my Elite controller.
Spooky.
I know.
Planned obsolescence.
I managed to fix it, but it cracked me up. I was like, are you fucking serious? Like, the controller still works great. It's just the grip got screwed up.
As the rubber fell away, there was an ad underneath it that revealed this next controller. And it was timed to the announcement. It was perfect. Incredible.
Right. It's like a QR code that takes you to the website to pre-order a new one. So that was sort of funny. But it still works. So happy ending, I guess. So things I played, I can just kind of quickly go through them. I've played a little bit of Doom 2016. I had mentioned wanting to finish that. And yeah, that game's really fun still. It's cool. It takes some adjusting because I played so much Destiny on PC, and Doom is also a fast-moving, very smooth first-person shooter, but there's no sprint button in Doom, and there's no reload button. And of course, this is something that everybody knows and remembers from that game, because there weren't sprint or reload buttons in the original Doom. But playing a game where your guy moves seriously at about, I don't know, 120 miles an hour or something, or maybe 80 miles an hour, just from a standstill. There is no, you know, middle ground. I guess there's like a walk button. And then that you never reload. You're just running around and shooting the whole time. It's a fun game. Anyway. So I've been playing some of that. I played a little bit of My Friend Pedro, which is the new side scroller that I can't remember who develops it. It's being published by Devolver. It's sort of like a Hotline Miami, Max Payne kind of thing. It's one of those games where you run into a room and there's a bunch of guys and you go into slow-mo and you jump around and you do all these crazy moves and shoot them.
Dead Toast Entertainment is the name of the developer.
Dead Toast. Okay, that sounds right. One of those irreverent sort of names. This game has a really great animated trailer that came out last week that reminded me that it exists. And I don't love it. I think it's cool, but it's not... there's something about the feel of it that's a little off. It's kind of ragdoll-y, which is interesting. Your character is kind of like a physics ragdoll, and then the bad guys are too. So if you ever watch a clip of this, you know, your guy will like skateboard into a room and spin through the air in slow-mo, like shooting dudes, and you're kind of controlling that with the thumbstick. But the feel isn't quite... I feel like Hollow Knight maybe spoiled me for side-scrolling games or something. I'll get to this with Bloodstained too, but it feels... It's different. And I bet if you play more and get used to it, it gets more fun, but I like it. It's fine. But it's like that, what's the Katana Zero game, or there's another one of these. There's kind of so many of these Hotline Miami shooter, like fast moving games, and they all kind of bounce off me. So didn't love it, but I might play a little bit more. And then I have played some Bloodstained Ritual of the Night, which is the long awaited Kickstarter Castlevania Symphony of the Night follow-up by the creative director. The director of that game was in charge of this. And
Igarashi.
And so
which version of the game did you play?
I'm playing on PC, which I gather is the best version. I hear
supposedly. Yes.
Yeah, I hear there are significant technical problems with the Switch version, which this game would be much better on Switch. And then also problems with the PS4 version. Anyway, it's good. I think people seem to really like it if you really like Symphony of the Night, which I do think Symphony of the Night is a really cool game. And it feels a lot like Symphony of the Night. I mean, just the aesthetic and vibe are very similar. It's got that kind of cheesy gothic feel in the music and just the way it looks and works. It's structured and designed very similarly. It has like more of a like anime aesthetic, I'd say. Though Symphony of the Night is fairly anime considering the time period. But it's a little bit more like JoJo poses. I see a lot of people talking about everyone in dialogue is doing a JoJo pose, and it's kind of rough in a lot of ways. Like the animations and cutscenes and just everything looks kind of janky. There's a lot of rough edges. It feels like they struggle to get it to hold together. And it seems like the bones are very good, but it needs another coat of paint. That's like mixing metaphors. But you know, it's one of those games.
How about the bones are good, but it needs another layer of skin.
It needs another it needs an exoskeleton of sorts. Yeah. So anyways, I do like it. I found myself playing it and enjoying it. I don't love the Castlevania combat feel. Like I just, like I was saying, Hollow Knight kind of ruined me because the combat in that game is so bouncy and tight and like really feels super, super good, where this is a little more just, I don't know, it's kind of like, it just feels different. I haven't like been drawn into the feel of playing it, but I do like it. I like it more than the other stuff I've been playing, I guess.
Yeah, I do think it's possible that Hollow Knight has like ruined Metroidvanias, at least for me too. Because I mentioned the other day, I was talking about Time Spinner, a game I was playing, and I really liked it, but like I couldn't even stick with it. And I was just like, I really want to play Hollow Knight or like Hollow Knight Silk Song, whatever that comes out. That's what I want. That's like the only Metroidvania that I want to play, because I don't know. I think at a certain point when you play a game that is like, that you just think this is the peak of this genre, nothing has done it better than this. It's hard to play something else.
I would differ from that a little bit, in that it's not that like I want all games to be Hollow Knight. It's just that once I've played a game that sets a standard that high,
well, that's what
I would prefer
about.
The games I'm playing meet it. Well, it's a little different. It's not like if I played another like Metroidvania that felt as good or was really fun in the same way Hollow Knight was, even if it was a little different, that would be fine. It's not like they all need to be Hollow Knight. It's just that game set a very high bar. And
that's what I'm saying. We're saying the same thing. That's what I'm saying. Saying that it's like playing a game that's like very good after playing something that is so excellent. It's just hard to go back to like good or very good after you've hit that bar.
I feel like what makes Hollow Knight stand out is actually the fact that it is so dissimilar from Metroid and Castlevania. Like, we call it a Metroidvania, but its whole look and feel, I mean, yeah, it's a 2D side-scroller. You collect stuff. You can, like, kind of get health packs, Metroid style. Like, there's some core similarities, obviously. You get different weapons, blah, blah, blah. But the look and the world and the whole concept of it is totally new and interesting and has its own thing going on and its own aesthetic, and it's a certain kind of music that fits with it. And I don't know. That's something I don't really see that many Metroidvanias do, for better or worse. Like, I mean, Axiom Verge is basically Metroid. Like, it's a lot of these games have that core issue.
Bloodstained is basically Symphony of the Night. Yeah.
But Bloodstained is like not even trying to pretend to be something other than that. It's literally like, this is a Symphony of the Night fan fiction with the serial numbers filed off, because that is the only way that we could make that happen. And as a result of that, it lives in the shadow of itself. And that is just by design, but also an inherent downside with it. And I don't know. The Hollow Knight comparison is almost unfair in that sense, because they're not trying to make something completely new. They're trying to do something very difficult by making something new that still satisfies fans of an old, specific, but very revered thing.
Right. And that's where I'm making the comparison, is in like what I like, right? Like, it's not saying, oh, this isn't Hollow Knight, therefore it's not good. It's saying this is actually very true to Castlevania, but I've never loved actually playing playing Castlevania games. I like Symphony of the Night because I like the design of it, but I don't like playing it. The combat just doesn't quite feel right. The jump doesn't feel right. I've never gotten used to it. And I loved playing Hollow Knight, so now I'm like, well, that's the thing I like, and this doesn't quite do that. So it's really just, that's what the comparison serves for me. But right, it's not like saying, this isn't good because it isn't, you know, this apple isn't good because
it
isn't
Hollow Knight, so it sucks.
This whole conversation just makes me want to go replay Hollow Knight. Like, what am I doing now? Why am I not playing Hollow Knight?
I don't know. I don't know.
All right. That is it for you, Kirk, right?
Yes.
We went over all the games you're playing. All right. Let's take a break, and then we will talk about some video game news.
Cool.
Okay. It's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hey, I'm Jamie.
And I'm Justina.
And we're the hosts of Just So You Know, a podcast where we get to the bottom of suspicious stories and outright lies we're being told by companies that profit off of animals.
You think Elon Musk is shady? Wait until you hear our episode about his sinister brain experiments.
First he ruined Twitter, now he's coming for your actual brain.
No.
We've also got one about that time I stormed the runway at New York Fashion Week to protest Coach's leather handbags.
Yeah, I heard they weren't happy about that.
I couldn't tell you. They're not talking to me at the moment.
And we're just getting started. In the coming weeks, we're going to blow the lid off of everything from shady pet dealers to monkeys held hostage by coconut milk companies to the astonishing secret behind the no animals were harmed message you see at the end of movies.
And so much more. We'll hope you join us for this surprisingly fun journey full of strange characters, secretive companies, and a whole world of stuff they really don't want you to know.
Subscribe to Just So You Know wherever you get your podcasts and look for our new episodes every Thursday. Just So You Know is a PETA production.
And we are back. Kirk, Maddie, let's get into some news, shall we?
Let's do it.
So usually the summer is pretty fallow for gaming news, but there are a few stories that I wanted to bring up this week to discuss. First of all, we have to talk about possibly the dumbest controversy in video games this year, which is, of course, Tifa's boobs. So a little bit of backstory, right? There was an article that came out a few days ago. I think it was on Gamatsu.com or something like that, where they were translating a Famitsu article that was basically like the director of the Final Fantasy VII remake saying, we had to tighten up Tifa's chest because Square Enix, their ethics department, told us to. And this set all sorts of waves of controversy, especially among the Gamergate crowd, who thought it was censorship of Tifa's breasts. Because you got to have your video game boobs, or else why even play video games? Like, if you're not gonna have giant breasts on your characters, why even?
It's the only reason I play them. So same. Yeah, I was really mad.
And so then it turned out, because of course it did, that this was actually a bad translation. And what he was actually saying was that Square Enix asked him to put her in a sports bra. So it's not that her boobs are actually like reduced in any way. And there have been all sorts of articles about this. I think I saw a good GameSpot one that was like delving into how bras work. It turns out that she's just wearing a sports bra. And so her boobs look smaller because they're compressed by the sports bra. This might have been the dumbest thing that I can remember seeing in a long time. I just can't understand, Maddie, why do people care?
I don't know. I have a secondary thought about why it's dumb that I almost tweeted, but then I was like, I don't want to open up this can of worms again.
Save
why am I
going
to say it on this show is a good question, but I'm about to do it anyway.
Because Gamergators don't listen to this
they
show.
Don't.
So,
don't tell them about it. So
that's the nice thing about
what
our
I was thinking about is when they made Advent Children, Tifa's boobs are smaller in that movie. Like, her whole design is pretty similar to the design they're using for this upcoming remake. Like, everybody kind of looks similar to how they did in that movie. They are differently proportioned. They don't have the same cartoony sort of like super big hands, super big feet, super big heads, and big boobs in Tifa's case. Like, that sort of cartoonish proportioning just isn't present there because they have a sort of more beautiful Bishonen style that they're doing in that movie. And that's basically what the style that this game is using. And I don't know. I just think it's funny. I was like, I didn't remember anybody complaining about Tifa's boobs being smaller in that movie. I don't think that happened. I think the only reason why people complain now is because of this one translation in a magazine. And even that translation, it's not just that the translation was bad. It's that I guess these magazines sort of circulate summaries of articles before the magazine actually comes out. So it was like a translation of an out of context paragraph from a scanned page summarizing what would be in the magazine later. And this, at least according to Brian Ashcroft, is something that always happens with this particular magazine, is that Famitsu, these summaries come out, they get translated by fans, people draw wild conclusions about what the full article is going to say, and then when the article comes out, it's like, okay, in the full context, it turns out there's a lot more information about this that like actually tells you the story, and maybe we all should have just waited for that. But no one can do that. So I don't know. Those are my thoughts on how dumb this was.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I just have to wonder, like, is there... So I'm trying to understand, other than the fact that a lot of these people are just like horny little boys who are like, oh my god, they can't touch my anime boobs.
I mean, I guess it's that, but it's also like getting mad for the sake of being mad.
Is there a question of like, is the censorship question something that is worth talking about? Like, is there any validity to the idea of like a company trying to censor its artistic vision? Like, I can't even see an argument for this. I'm just trying to understand if there's more, if there's any sort of validity to where this is coming from, or if it really is just the dumbest conversation in the world. Kirk, do you have any thoughts?
No, I mean, this just sounds like a bad information pipeline that led to a controversy about something that didn't exist. I don't really know where to go with it past that, right? It makes me think of Patricia Hernandez's article about boobs and video games that she wrote many years ago now, that I haven't read in a while, but I remember it being this sort of just deep dive look at the long history of video games and breasts and just the way that those two things have always sort of been intertwined and how complicated and controversial it can become. So I remember that being a good article, but no, I don't really have much to add here.
Yeah, my contribution is that Tifa looks ridiculous in pixelated form, but so do all the other characters. So if they're making him realistic, then that's what it is.
Or not necessarily realistic, but within this certain art style they've chosen. Go on.
Yeah. And B, this is making me think, did you guys ever play Super Mario RPG?
Yeah, we played it together. Remember, we streamed it.
Yeah, but did you ever play the whole thing? You never played the whole thing, because that was your first time playing, right? Okay, at the near the end of the game, there's this boss character, and it's this woman who's like a queen or something, some evil queen who's taken over Mallow's country. And I remember every time you hit her in the game, her like massive boobs would jiggle, like every time you hit her. And I remember, this is just making me think of that, I remember playing, I think I must have been 10 years old when I played this for the first time, and it was very confusing for me. I was like, what is going on right now? And so I guess if you grew up and you were like prepubescent when you first saw Tifa's boobs, maybe you have some weird attachment to them.
I don't think that's it though, because the reaction did not happen with Advent Children. Yeah. I think it only happened because of this article, which proves that it's a fake controversy, because
totally fake.
Like,
totally
she's
stupid.
Already been specifically redesigned in this exact style, and like her body's been redesigned. All the characters' bodies have been redesigned. No one cared. People liked the look of that movie, but they only cared because this article, or the positioning and framing of this
article. You know what? No, I have another thought. People don't actually care. A lot of it is that I remember there was this fantastic video by a YouTuber named Sean Jen a few months ago.
Oh, yeah. Gita relinked this recently.
Yeah. And so like, it's about how the YouTube economy works and how all these like anti-SJW YouTubers don't even give a shit about anything. And they'll just like take a single tweet and turn that into like, oh my God, social justice warriors at it again. And basically it's what they accuse media of doing, except they are actually doing and making a bunch of money for it. I think that was a large part of this equation. Like, oh my god, like you can just imagine the YouTube thumbnails in your mind, like SJW's at it again, Tifa's boobs censored in big red letters. So yeah, that I think that's a very large part of this whole quote-unquote controversy. Let's move on. Let's talk about more interesting things. So auto chess. Do you guys know auto chess, the auto battler genre? Have you been following this genre?
I've been following Nathan Grayson's articles about it on Kotaku.com.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I was going to get at.
Same. I would love for you or Maddie to explain this, though, in a way that listeners can understand, because I don't play these games. I've seen Nathan's coverage, but I'm still a little loose on the details because I've never played one. So I'd love to hear what that is. What is auto chess? Yeah.
So I don't know why it's called auto chess, because it has nothing to do with chess, but very short version. This started as a Dota 2 mod that came out earlier this year, became super popular. Basically, you have battles on screen. You have units that you put into battle and they fight your opponent's units and you don't actually control them. So hence the auto part. They're going at it. And the strategy involved is like, what kind of upgrades am I going to get? Which units am I going to place? And then there's a bunch of randomness involved because every single turn you're like selecting new random units. And that's my very short explanation of it, but basically it become this super addictive thing, kind of like a mix between a MOBA and like a card battler like Hearthstone, right? So the reason I bring it up is because I think it's going to become, or is already becoming, and people are just like slow to pick up on the fact that it's the hottest genre of this year. It's becoming humongous on Twitch. Riot Games has released an auto battler game. Valve has released an auto battler game. Basically, it's becoming this whole wave, this phenomenon. Basically, it's this time next year we might be seeing like EA and Activision be like, here's our version of
it.
Like the new battle royale.
I'd be okay with that, having read Nathan's most recent guide to auto chess and what it is and what's appealing about it, which I really enjoyed. I started to kind of be converted and be like, oh, maybe I should check this out, because the way he describes it is, because it's a multiplayer game, it's a competitive multiplayer game, but it's different from a MOBA in the sense that actions aren't necessarily happening in real time. Like, you kind of make your decisions and then you don't get a break per se, but you just sort of watch what happens. And that's different from a competitive game where everything is happening in real time and people can get really mad at you. And so the flow of the game and the way that people react to the game seems different and kind of friendlier, or at least that's how Nathan described it and why
sense.
He likes it. So as far as competitive games go, I think this structure sounds pretty appealing, at least to me. So yeah, I'm going to give it a shot. I'll let you guys know next week if I'm addicted
that's good.
To auto
yeah,
chess.
That's a
yes,
good idea. As much
thoughts.
As I'll probably play it at some point, that sounds more fun, is that you can play it and then I will
For me
I
to
will
play
stay
it
tuned.
Until, yeah, way
yeah,
more
and then
fun.
I can
way,
play it.
Way,
it's
way
it's fun to stagger these things out.
Yeah, I just wanted to put this on our radar so we can be like Kotaku Split Screen ahead of the curve, following these trends, keeping up to date on all the hot new genres. but yeah, it seems really interesting. It seems like super addictive. Nathan was the way Nathan's been talking about it. It seems like he like got instantly hooked.
Yeah, he has a problem. Possibly.
It's very funny. All of his articles begin with some outlandish story of how addicted he is to the game. Which is
making a huge mistake by even saying I'm going to try this.
There's a really good formula to like being addictive, and it involves A, really short matches, and B, like having some sort of compulsive appeal to your like vices, like the gambling part of it, or like the just one more turn. And it seems like the auto chess genre
also,
is good at that.
I think that it helps to like chemically release things in your brain like that make you crave it if you don't have it. I think that helps for addictiveness too. I've heard that.
If you have a brain that produces dopamine, for example, and endorphins, that's really helpful. That might help you get addicted to something.
That can be
very
helpful.
Very useful. Yeah, very, very good context. Thank you both. Thank you for that explanation.
Sure.
I think we should get into that more. I think we should discuss more about like the way that our brains work.
Drugs,
do you have any brain science lessons to offer?
No, I want to think about how we can make split screen more addictive, though. So let's work on that. So we need to go in short bursts, like little episodes, and then that's good. There's some element of randomness.
Just randomize, like you don't know what game you're going to hear us.
We
talk
make
about.
An episode, and then we cut it up into like 15 different pieces, and you never know which part you're going to get depending on.
Amazing, incredible idea,
and you have to pay for a box that may contain, it has a 2% chance of containing a good one.
Oh, man.
Otherwise, you're probably just going to get a shitty episode.
Or it might just contain like 16 gamer jokes read aloud.
It might. You never know.
No, well, that'll be what everyone's chasing for.
Are you guys I hope you're both ready to get rich, because I think we've struck gold here.
The 1% gold, 1% chance of getting the ultimate, the epic legendary reward. That's just Kirk reading gamer jokes.
that I just Googled and found online.
Super rare item. Yeah, it would be great.
All right. So in more serious news, we should talk about Call of Duty, because this week we published a big investigation into Treyarch, the company behind Black Ops. And short version, Treyarch staffers say that contractors and especially testers are really mistreated there. They're really low. They're paid poorly. They go through really grueling periods of crunch. Some of the QA testers just told some horrible stories about working with no air conditioning and having to park in a different lot and like not being allowed to take food until all the other developers had taken, and then they can wait an hour and maybe get some leftovers if they're lucky. Go read the story. But it all raises a lot of questions about the way that big corporations use contractors. And I'm sure media companies do this a lot. I'm sure our company has done it quite a bit over the years, because it's just a thing that companies do to get around not having to pay you full-time salaries or full-time benefits or whatever else it is that people actually deserve to get paid. It all begs the question, is capitalism broken?
Seems fine. I think it's good. And people getting rich at the top and no one else getting rich seems good and fair to me. No, but seriously, though, I was really sad reading your story, Jason, especially since I've talked about enjoying Blackout so much on this show. And that was one of the things that you cited as having been made under extreme crunch in the story, at least according to the people that you spoke to.
That's and for sure.
I don't know. I was just sad to hear it. I like Call of Duty games, and I feel like the entire system described, like QA testers being on a totally different floor and being treated like, I mean, there are contractors who are contracted by a completely different company, and it seemed like there would never be any chance for upward mobility for any of them either, which is something that I've heard from other people who work QA just at other studios, is that you get a job like that thinking, oh, I'm going to finally work in the games industry, like QA, that's the entry level job I should take, and then eventually I'll be a game designer or some other lead on a different part of design. And you never really get out of it, seemingly, or a lot of people struggle to get out of it, because you just end up in this churn of working a lot, never really getting noticed, not really having the opportunity to like elevate higher concerns to your bosses, and not really being heard or recognized if you happen to be a better QA tester than one of the other billions of other QA testers, and you're seen as replaceable, et cetera, et cetera. So like, I don't know, the way it was described in this particular studio in your story sounded really bad, even compared to stories I've heard where they're on a separate floor, they don't even get to talk to other people, and their other employees are told not to talk to QA. I don't know. It was really some wild anecdotes in that story.
Yeah, the isolation and just ostracizing of QA people, I think, is a big problem there. And yeah, like you said, I think a lot of people who started as QA people were in the video game industry were able to build their careers by like going and talking to the associate producer and saying, hey, can I help out here? Can I do some production work? And like, you prove yourself that way by like going above and beyond and doing extra stuff.
Or like talking to other employees and being like, oh, it turns out I'm really interested in this thing or this design and I'm learning these new skills or what have you. But if you can't talk to other departments, then how do you ever do those things or move up or make inroads, network, blah, blah, blah? You can't.
Right. And then meanwhile, you're seeing all the headlines about how Call of Duty Black Ops 4 made $500 million in its first 3 days.
Each of these things kind of is just one more illustrative point of these broader issues that we're having with capitalism. And that's like beyond my pay grade, or at least not something I'm an expert in. Everyone knows, I think, that I like the Ezra Klein show. He's been interviewing a lot of politicians, and he had Elizabeth Warren on recently. She was saying like, yes, I still think capitalism is good, but there are these problems with it. And she's all about kind of trying to fix them. There are a lot of sort of people in the Democratic primary, they're trying to figure this stuff out. And it seems to me like each example like this, whenever I hear it and then hear people talking about it, it highlights the same problem, which is that the basic idea of like, if you have a better job at a company, you maybe get better perks and you have a better office or a better parking spot. Like, you worked really hard and you got higher and you get paid more, and then eventually you're in charge, you make the money. Like, just taken from that perspective, I totally get the argument that's like, well, that works and that drives people to do better and like, and you know, achieve more, and that's like, it's this engine for like, for the economy and for wealth, and that's good.
But if only meritocracy worked, right?
Well, and so we keep looking at things, and this article, I think, is a good example of this, of like various ways that over time the system has warped or been changed or built into the ways that that's not possible. Maddie, the thing you're talking about, where like the idea of coming in as a QA person is basically, it's like the mailroom thing, right? You move to New York and you start in the mailroom and you work your way up to the top office, you know? And that was always kind of the dream of bootstrapping yourself in capitalism. And that's a great dream. It'd be really cool if the system allowed for that. But like you're saying, you're not even a Treyarch employee if you're in QA there. So there's this built-in ceiling that, I don't know if it works this way at every company, or maybe if you're really good, you could somehow apply for a job at Treyarch and you'd have a better chance of getting it or something. But it feels more and more like there are these barriers now put in place to keep the serfs down and to keep the people at the top up in the aristocracy in control. And that's not good. And then you look at the numbers, like you said, yeah, $500 million or whatever on some game, and think, shouldn't everyone just be being treated a little bit better than they are? Like, couldn't we maybe erase some of this discrepancy? So yeah, that's my big picture thought on that.
Yeah, well, it seems like, I mean, yeah, I don't really consider myself a socialist, but I consider myself someone who believes that capitalism needs to be pretty heavily regulated or else it turns into what you have now. And I think the ultimate problem is that without some sort of like collective bargaining, without some sort of unionization, without some sort of organization, the workers just are left to be every person for themselves. And so they don't have any negotiating power. So if you come in and you apply for a job at Treyarch and you're one of thousands of people who wants a QA job there and they're very limited and so they have an endless supply of people, then you have absolutely no say or leverage or negotiation power. So of course they can make you work for $13 an hour and like sit in the pit cramped together with other people, and your conditions don't matter to them. I think ultimately the only way to solve that is with a union, and then when everybody's banded together and saying, hey, like we're one for all for one, we're not going to be just like totally every man for themselves negotiating on our own, like fuck everyone else, we're going to be standing together. I think that is the way that you can push for real change and say, hey, let's make sure there's a base level of treatment that everyone has.
Yeah, I would add to that that I think that like legislation is very important, and that the judges that are making decisions on legal cases related to this are also very important. So like the political side of this matters quite a bit too. It's not just about unionization.
Yeah, but that is like, we have way less control over that.
I mean, they're all things that like, I don't have any control over whether game developers unionize, but I do have control over who I vote for and who I support. So actually in some ways, they're all things, they're all axes by which to attack this problem.
I'm not talking about things we can do. I'm saying if you're a QA person at Treyarch, if you're an associate designer at Infinity Ward, whatever it is, you have way less power over the judges and voting. I mean, you get to exercise that power like what, once a year, twice a year, or once every 2 years. If you're as opposed to unionizing, which anyone can just organize and put something together. And like,
yeah, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to make this into some sort of an either or thing between these two things. I'm just saying like, these are two axes with which to approach the problem. Like we don't need to start comparing legislative versus unionization. Like they all matter. Like, I just mean there are a lot of ways to approach this problem.
I see what you're saying. Okay. Got it. Yeah. But ultimately, I mean, I think what this sort of thing shows is that like the unregulated capitalism and the idea of like a meritocracy where everyone can just prove themselves is clearly not going to work, because not everybody is given the opportunity to prove themselves and prove that they deserve a higher position and a better position. Because if these systems are just like repressing everyone and devaluing everyone, then there's literally no way to stand out.
Yeah. And also it's really hard to make a union or get one together if you're working that many hours. Like, that's a really great way to ensure that no one ever complains. Like, they've really set it up well for that, because people are so tired and so overworked and also making just barely enough money by working all of this overtime, and they have to work the overtime to make a salary that's livable for where they are. Uh-huh. It's like, when do you have the free time to go out for drinks and organize a union or whatever? Like, when do you even have the free time to sleep or do anything? I mean, this is part of why people have trouble organizing, is because they're like, well, I don't have the time to do that because the system's been designed so that I'd never do. I don't know. That's a negative place to leave it.
No, that's super true.
It is
though.
How I felt reading it. I was like, this would be such a hard situation. Like, I don't know. It might be easier for people at another company where maybe conditions aren't as bad. Like, we've talked about this a lot with unions, about how usually they start at a place where conditions are actually pretty good and where negotiating with your boss or owner is more possible, because in those circumstances, it's like, let's just try to keep the good thing we have. I think that's a lot more likely to happen. And then that could hopefully spiral out into affecting employees like these ones who, as far as I can tell, don't have the means to create a union right now. And just, there's not I don't know. But that conversation is definitely getting more normalized. And that's really been cool to see, like, more and more people talking about workers' rights and being like, hey, this isn't cool. Because I don't know, QA testing has sucked for a long time, actually. Like, I guess you could argue it's getting worse, but I don't think it was ever that great of a job. So it's nice to see the conversation change.
No, never. And in fact, no, I think it has gotten better at most places. It's just that Treyarch is very much a company that is like still doing the types of things it was doing 10, 15 years ago. Like, as a lot of companies have tried to reduce crunch and tried to just like create environments where people are not working 12-hour shifts and like coming in every Saturday, I think Treyarch has really embraced it, in large part because of a lot of communication issues and rebooting some of the stuff that I talked about in the article. It turns out, I don't know if you guys knew this or if you saw in the piece, but like Black Ops 3 was supposed to be an open world game until it shifted halfway through production. Black Ops 4 was supposed to have this 2v2 campaign until that was cut and Blackout was made in the last like 9 months of development. So that, I think, is like a large part of it, is just like management's inability to make a plan and stick with it winds up trickling down and affecting everybody else. And by the way, making a plan and sticking with it is easy to say, much harder to do, especially when you're talking about video games where you have to find the fun and figure out if things technically work. So this is not exactly an easy problem to solve. But yeah, I mean, the fact that like people can just see these headlines about like Bobby Kotick making $30 million a year while they're making $13 an hour and like literally work at the office building next door to where the C-suite of Activision is. It's just like something is fundamentally wrong here. Like the fact that can happen, that level of disparity can happen, is just like a sign that something needs to change, in my humble opinion. All right, why don't we take another quick break and then we will get into some off-topic chat.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
And we are back. Kirk, Maddie, let's speed run our way through some off-topic chat. Kirk, why don't you start us off? What have you been watching and checking out?
First of all, just last week we talked about Always Be My Maybe, and a listener wrote in to point out that I had said that the members of the characters in the characters on the movie were Korean American, when in fact there are a variety of nationalities represented in that movie. So that was my bad. I was kind of talking off the top of my head. Apologies for that. I finished Veep a few weeks ago, but then I didn't talk about it on the show. And I think you both finished Veep, is that right?
No, I still haven't. It's on my to-do list.
You should. Yeah, it's really good.
I did. I talked about the ending and how good it was a couple weeks
ago. Yeah, so I liked the last couple episodes a lot. The last season was really rough. It was really mean. That was kind of my initial impression of it, and I was struggling with it. That was all on purpose. The ending is hardcore. It's an amazing ending. Like, anyone who watched the show should watch it. And I really recommend this Vulture article as like an accompaniment or sort of chaser to finishing it. It put the whole show in a different context for me and is really incredible. We'll link it in show notes. It's like a set visit during the shooting of the final season, and it gets all into like Julia Louis-Dreyfus and like her whole thing and like her process and the writer's room process and how they workshop a joke and how they worked out these final this like final shots of the season. And man, it gave me a new appreciation for how good that show is. Like, I already knew, but it's easy to kind of forget, especially with a half an hour show, that people, this is their life. Like, they have been living this show for years and years and years, and it's coming to an end. And it was all about how they keep crying when they're doing their shots and they all love each other so much, which is so interesting when it's a show that's about these horrible people who hate each other. And you're so used to watching them just be really cruel, and how like they even talk about how some of the scenes in the final.
So funny.
It's an amazing article. And like, it gave me an even more of an appreciation for the final season for the show. So that was really cool. And Veep is an amazing show. It was quite an achievement. I've watched more Schitt's Creek, which I mentioned, I think, a couple off topics ago. That show has really grown into itself and has become quite wonderful. I really like it. It's got a I don't want to say Parks and Rec because it's totally different in a lot of ways, but you know how Parks and Rec makes you feel good and is also very funny? It's like got that going on. They basically, so this show is, I've mentioned this before, but this is from Daniel and Eugene Levy, who are like, it's a lot of people from the sort of Canadian improv comedy scene. Catherine O'Hara is in it. Some people from like the Mighty Wind, Spinal Tap scene and some of those folks.
Yep.
And then Daniel
incredible
Levy.
People. Incredible.
Oh yeah. And Daniel Levy is amazing. He's Eugene Levy's son and he writes a lot of the episodes and the two of them created the show. It's like, and actually they're, I think her name is Sarah, also plays a character, Sarah Levy. So Daniel's sister. So it's got a lot of, the whole Levy clan is there.
And that's wild. He created a show with his son and his sister. That's so cool.
And they play father and son on the show. And it's the story of these kind of failed, it's a little Arrested Development-y in the setup. They're like a failed, really rich family that then lost all their money because the FBI just came, or the IRS came and took all their money. And they moved to this town that that the father bought as a joke for his son called Schitt's Creek. And like, they still somehow own that because the government decided that it's worthless technically, so they don't want to repossess it. So they wind up just living in the motel in this town. And that's the premise. And it's just a sitcom. It's half an hour. And at first, it was kind of, it was funny and it's really watchable and light. This is kind of how I described it last time. The characters are kind of caricatures. The whole thing is very silly. But now I'm in the second season. They've made a decision to make the characters into real people. And you get these, they're all really good actors. And suddenly you get these just little scenes of really sweet stuff between them as they're all kind of growing as people and becoming better. And I hear that only goes, like, grows as the show goes on. So it's really good. I'm now like really into it. When at first I was like, oh, it's cute and light. Now I think it's like really wonderful. So it's like a nice show to just put on and watch if you want something that's fun and funny and light. And then the other thing is I just watched an episode or two, I guess two episodes of Evangelion, which Maddie, I'm guessing you watched more, and I'll let you just talk about it. So that's it for me.
Wait, it's sure. I always read it as Evangelion.
It's Evangelion. Not. It's, there's a hard G, first of all. Mm-hmm. Evangelion. Wow. Yeah. So I had actually never seen Evangelion in my youth. I just didn't watch it. But it's like one of these things that just has permeated the cultural consciousness so much that in finally watching it, which a lot of people are because it's on Netflix now, so a lot of people are finally watching it, including you, Kirk. I don't know if you'd ever seen it, right?
I had. I didn't watch the whole thing, but I'd watched like 15 or so episodes, 10 to 15 episodes, something like the first half or so, and then I didn't finish for reasons. I think if I had known that it was 23 minute long episodes that I just would have watched the whole thing. I'm definitely going to watch it because like it's such a major cultural artifact, but I'm curious what you make of it because you've watched more than me.
Yeah, I mean, my basic opinion is I'm really enjoying it and I've kind of been like, I guess this is why this became such a wildly popular
out it's good.
anime. Like it's got great themes. It's got just like a cool spooky core idea. I mean, it's I have no deep analysis of it. A lot of people have made some great memes about how Misato, who's like the 29-year-old heroine, one of the heroines, is like the first millennial.
The original millennial. I've seen that.
Very enjoyable. I mean, it's sort of timeless. It's an apocalypse story, and I think those resonate a lot with people now. So the fact that it's on Netflix now is very much hitting the spot for a lot of people, and also for people my age who maybe watched it when they were 15 and then now are rewatching it. A lot of my friends are in that same kind of boat. So it's been fun to see it, and it's also been fun to be finally watching it and talking about it to people who saw it ages ago and how differently they feel about it, having watched it as teenagers. And usually people relate very strongly as teenagers to the teenage characters in the show, but then when they rewatch it, they relate more to like Misato and the older adult characters. And it's cool that the show has both of those sides of a generation in it, and that both of those sides are interestingly represented. So yeah, I'm enjoying it. I know the end is notoriously bad. I haven't yet watched the last three or four episodes. I'm so excited for it to let me down and be terrible because it's going to be great. So the other thing is that I've
Slytherin over here.
Yeah, what's up? So I've been reading this book, Jason, that you actually recommended ages ago called The Journalist and the Murderer.
Yeah.
I've actually been reading this book for the past 6 months. I've just had to take thousands of breaks from it because it stresses me out so much.
Oh,
and I kept
man.
Being like, eventually I'm going to finish this book and I'm going to be able to tell Jason I finished it and that I enjoyed it on some level. But did I? Because this book is genuinely so stressful. So it's a nonfiction book. It's about a murder case that happened where a journalist
Janet Malcolm.
Yeah, where a journalist was sort of allowed into the backstage of this investigation of this murder trial and found out all this information that usually only lawyers get to know and became very close with the accused murderer over the course of reporting this story, which is very unusual situation. And then he wrote this book about the murderer in which, or accused murderer, in which he basically turns on him, and despite having been seemingly friends or palling around with this guy, this the accused, for so long, he then turned around and wrote this book basically saying, so this guy's a murderer and I hung out with him this whole time and like now I've decided that. And so then that creates this rift between them, and the guy who the book is about sues him and is like, you misled me. And the whole book is about, you know, how close can journalists get? And like, is it acceptable for them to misrepresent themselves in order to get a story?
Oh,
and like,
man, to what extent is that?
I don't know. It's so stressful because I've listened to the audiobook, which means that you have to listen to someone read aloud these incredibly uncomfortable letters where the journalist is like essentially sucking up to his source, who he, I guess, believes is a murderer by this point. But in these letters is just like laying praise upon him. And it's so weird to hear them read aloud. I'm sure it would have been just as weird to read it, but somehow hearing it was... It just gave me the heebie-jeebies, for lack of a better term.
That makes me think of, what was the Netflix show about serial killers? I'm forgetting the name of it. Mindhunter.
Mindhunter,
It makes me think of that a little, where he's kind of flattering the serial killer to get him to talk more, but it's also, like, freaking out his partner because his partner's like, dude, do you like this? What is this? What is going on?
It's
this guy's a
killer.
It's
a similar vibe to that, but it's also nonfiction. So you're like, fuck, this happened in real life. Like, people sent these letters.
Well, I mean, Mindhunter was nonfiction. Actors.
I'm pretty sure they exaggerated some stuff to make you know, a perfect TV show. It's not perfect. I liked it, but it whatever. This book. So
do you buy? Do you buy what? Like the? I mean, the basic point that she was trying to make is essentially like every journalist is always like betraying their sources and like everything that a journalist does is unethical.
I mean, do you think that that's the conclusion she comes to? Because so the woman who's written the book has this sort of interesting epilogue to it, where she sort of talks about a situation that wasn't exactly the same, but where she also had become close to a source and then ended up getting sued for it later. And she was like, and so because this happened to me, there might be people reading this book and just assuming that I'm only writing this book because I had a personal connection to it. And that's interesting. It's all very meta. And then she doesn't fully come to a conclusion, I don't think. Like, I just finished the book this week, so it's very fresh in my memory. And that epilogue is weird. She's kind of like, yeah, you have to do this on some level, but also do you? That's kind of the conclusion, is her seeming to not know what she thinks about it.
Yeah, I haven't read it. So I haven't read it in a decade or so.
Right, yeah.
So my memory is not as fresh as yours. But I remember this being like a topic of conversation because it led to all these questions about like the ethics of source development and cultivation, especially when you're doing long form reporting and doing nonfiction narrative reporting, which is a world of its own.
Or like crime reporting, where you need to be getting close to a source who has possibly done some very terrible things and ask them about those things, but ask them in such a way that they actually tell you what happened.
It makes for an interesting contrast. So I was just listening to Michael Lewis on Ezra Klein's show at Kirk's recommendation.
Telling everybody to listen to Ezra Klein. That's my thing. It's a good podcast.
So Michael Lewis is, of course, one of the most renowned journalists, one of my favorite authors, and he wrote The Blind Side and Moneyball and The Fifth Risk and a bazillion other things. He's an incredible, prolific author and journalist. And he's talking about how his way of source development is like he finds these interesting people and he talks about how he will like play basketball games with them and he won't use a voice recorder and he just relies on his memory for information and takes notes occasionally. And anyway, he talks about how like oftentimes after a book is published, he'll wind up like staying friends with some of these people and like developing close friendships with them, which is another interesting way of going about it. And that also raises interesting ethical questions of like, is it really ethical to become close friends with the person that you're writing a story about, even if it's after the fact? And yeah, I don't know. These are questions that have been dogging journalists for a very long time, and they will certainly not be answered by us today.
That Michael Lewis interview is really good, by the way. I think I would have mentioned that on off topic, but I just didn't think of it. But
maybe
I loved that interview.
A little palate cleanser for myself.
He's a character. I didn't realize what a character
it's really,
he is. He's
oh
really
man,
fun
Maddie,
to
you'll
to.
Yeah, you'll really enjoy it. Michael Lewis is just like a super inspirational, like charismatic dude, and just the way he talks and the way he like analyzes Ezra Klein, just listening to him.
Yeah, that part's funny. Yeah, it's good.
Because even when you're just like you can tell that he's just like a curious like person, someone who's interested in other people. And that to me is super inspirational. You can tell that when you're listening to them talk, he's just asking all these questions. And it's just like this very natural thing that not a lot of people do, which is just get really, really interested in the person you're talking to. And I think that's really useful, not only for journalism, but just in life in general, is to be interested in the people you're talking to. Anyway, I could talk about this stuff forever, but let's not, because we're speedrunning.
Even though we're already terrible job speedrunning.
Yeah, sure we are. Sure we are.
Yeah, we're already way over an hour into this episode. I actually don't have a ton of stuff to talk about because I've been working on this Treyarch story during a lot of my spare time. But I have been still watching Billions with my wife, still enjoying the hell out of that show.
Nice.
We're like a few episodes into season two. We just watched this great episode with the poker tournament.
Oh, that episode's great.
And Taylor, who's this non-binary character.
Played
and they
by
do
a
this
non-binary
really clever,
actor, which is
that's always nice.
Yeah, and they do this really clever thing to humanize. So they're so good at like humanizing the two anti-heroes at the center of this.
And Taylor is also kind of an anti-hero, or sort of becomes one as well. Like everyone in the show is an anti-hero.
Yeah, well, so they do this really smart thing. The showrunners do this really smart thing where they surround Bobby Axelrod, who's the billionaire insider trading evil genius, by like total dicks. So the people around him are so much worse than he is, and it makes you like him by default. So like, for example, some of the people who work for him are like insulting Taylor, and they're like call them an it or like a her, and he corrects those people. He's like, actually it's them. And it gives you like this little moment of like, oh, this guy is like an empathetic person who respects Taylor's gender and like their pronoun choices. And so that's just like a really cool moment and just like a great story trick.
But then it's also like Bobby is like
but
wildly
it's also,
unethical
this asshole.
Person
totally.
Other ways. So you're like, God damn it. All right, show.
It's like when the villain like picks up a puppy on the street and like, it's just like those little humanizing moments.
Yeah, but that's also part of how Bobby gets Taylor like into his clutches is by being like, look, I'll treat you very well at this company and like I'm gonna respect you and like be kind of like a paternal figure to you and like make you feel safe here, and then also teach you wildly unethical trading practices in this like high powered finance firm. And I don't know, it's amazing. I like Billions.
It's really, really, really good show. I really, really enjoy it. And then I also finished the book that I mentioned the other week, Norse Mythology by Neil Gaiman, which is his retelling of all these Nordic mythological tales, and it's fantastic. I highly recommend it to anyone who's interested in just mythology in general, and Neil Gaiman obviously is a fantastic storyteller. And that is it. Kirk, give us your music pick of the week.
All right. Well, my music pick of the week is informed by the strong songs on the new episode that just came out, which is Janelle Monáe. It's finally time to do Janelle Monáe on Strong Songs. Yeah, man. So I did Tightrope from her 2010 album, The Arch Android.
Amazing.
Yeah, that song is amazing. And there's always a thing I do where I'm like, okay, I'm going to do this song. And then I put it on for the first time after making that decision. And I really listen to it because I'm like, what am I going to talk about? And that song has so much going on. Like, I knew there was a lot going on, but there's even more going on than I realized. There's so much cool shit. Allow it, 'cause baby, whether you're high. It's awesome. People should go listen to that episode. It's a very fun episode. While I was working on that, I wanted to talk some about James Brown and about her, like the way that she channels James Brown specifically on that song. One of the things I love about Janelle Monáe is how she can be Prince one minute and James Brown the next minute and Sharon Jones the next minute and whoever, like 100 different people. She like has this amazing ability. And I was listening to James Brown and found this track called Mother Popcorn that I'd never heard. And it's such a... it's my music pick because everyone knows like I Feel Good and the big James Brown hits. This one is just the James Brown and the JBs like doing their thing. It's him just like doing his call outs and the horns playing hits, and it's funky as hell. And I just never heard it. And it's just distilled James Brown for like 4.5 minutes or something. So here's a clip of that. Yeah. Yeah, man, James Brown. It's cool that there's people carrying the torch. I feel like that makes me very happy. And yeah, I was very excited to talk about Janelle because she's so fucking
and
good.
Everyone go listen to Strong Songs.
This is a good one. Definitely a good one.
Have you finished your new theme song?
I have, actually. It's on SoundCloud. Maybe I'll play a clip or something. It was fun. I had my friend BJ come over and play trumpets, so he laid down the trumpet parts.
And of course, you know, everything needs a horn section. So you were like, exactly. I better make sure that in addition to my own prowess at horn instruments, I have someone else as well.
Yeah, you got to have the brass in there. It's funny because there's almost nothing. I do feel this way. I can play woodwinds. And so I'll like record kind of the horn section with just saxophones, but you need brass. Preferably trumpet, trombone, tenor sax is like the perfect horn section because you need that like that shimmer and that pop that the trumpets give you. And I was using sample trumpets initially and they sound like okay. Oof. When you have a real saxophone in there with them, it's like passable. But man, when BJ came in and played, because he's like really good at trumpet, and it was very cool. Also, BJ and I actually played in band in high school together. That's a fun fact. He is brilliant trumpet player who moved out here to Portland recently. He works at Monette Trumpets, which is this amazing trumpet maker. They make like all the most beautiful trumpets in the world, and he works there, and I got to have him come record like 20 years after I graduated from high school, which is pretty cool.
Oh, that's awesome. Yeah. Music
that is
bringing people together.
Yeah, it really does.
Years later. All right, that will be it for this week's speed run of an episode, which will probably clock in at like, what, an hour 20?
We did our best, okay? We did our best.
Listen.
It happens.
It's the best we can do.
Yep. It happens. This is not a world record. We do not properly execute all the glitches, all the time-saving tricks. Yeah.
This is an any percent, et cetera.
Yeah. This is an any percent. No, I think we need to do an 100%. Otherwise, we would just end in the podcast.
Like 5 minutes early. Look, sorry. This is an any percent.
This is an any percent run. All right. That is it for this week. We will be back next week. I think we're going to publish a little bit early because next week, July 4th, is on Thursday. So you might get this, we'll get next week's episode on Wednesday of next week. A little special surprise right in your podcast feed.
Very exciting.
A little bit early. Goodbye, Kirk. Goodbye, Maddie. Farewell. See you all next week.
Bye.
Bye.
Kotaku Split Screen is an official podcast of Kotaku.com. It's produced by Kirk Hamilton, Jason Schreier, and me, Maddie Myers. Kirk edits and mixes the podcast and also wrote and performed our theme song and other music. We are a part of the Fusion Podcast Network, where Mandana Mabidi is executive producer of audio. You can find us on popular podcast services like Panoply, NPR One, Google Play, and Apple Podcasts, and we hope you'll leave us a review if you like what you hear. Find old episodes at kotaku.com/splitscreen. Email us at splitscreen@kotaku.com.